Hello, Kristen.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing A-okay. it's been an all right week for me. I'm now, it seems as though the 2012 race has really kicked into full gear. So as a political junkie, now the fun begins, I think.
Well, are you of the ilk that says the field is settled and it looks like a three-person race between Romney and Perry and Bachmann, or are you of the Karl Rove school that Paul Ryan and Chris Christie and Giuliani all may jump into?
Palin. I'm going to take the safer position and say the field's not settled. Anybody could jump in, because I don't think anybody's really going to hold it against somebody if they say, you know what, there's a chance the field's not settled yet. But if I come out right now and say, nope, nobody else is getting in, it's like I'm tempting fate. It's like I'm begging for someone else to get in and prove me wrong. I think that if the field's not set, it has certainly come into focus much more clearly. There has been so much talk up until, you know, now about who will emerge as the Romney alternative. Because there are folks that like Romney, they're okay with voting for him. And then there's everybody else. And everybody else was really splintered between, you know, are you a Bachmann non-Romney, or are you a Paul non-Romney, or, you know, what person do you latch on to? I think now with Perry's emergence, it is popping up that he looks to be one of the strongest contenders. Now, he has just jumped into the race, and so there's all this positive stuff out there about him that is only just now beginning to sort of get debunked. I mean, I guarantee you, as you and I are taping this, there are journalists and researchers from every campaign getting on planes, going down to Austin, and figuring out how to poke holes in many of the good things that Rick Perry will have to say about himself. But, you know, with Pawlenty dropping out and Perry kind of surging to the front, it's coming into bigger focus rather than being set.
Well, I think perhaps you don't spend that much of your week on the liberal blogs. But as soon as Perry got in, there's just been a flood of liberal blogging trying to upset the narrative that Texas is some sort of a golden story about job creation. Arget's really been led by a non-blogger or honorary blogger, Paul Krugman, who's done a couple of columns over the past few months sort of preparing for this moment to say that the Texas story is not all it's cracked up to be. Think Progress has practically been Perry Central lately.
I can imagine.
So you're seeing all sorts of different lines being taken, that the jobs are, a lot of them are low-wage, no-benefit jobs, that Perry's a job poacher, not a job creator, unemployment went up just like everywhere else in the past 2 years, so it's not even that there's been this fantastic job growth there. A lot of the jobs he cites are over a 10-year period, not necessarily a 2-year period. Some of it is oil boom, which he has nothing to do with. And I believe there's even a post over at Times, a Swampland blog, saying that part of what he's doing is his government program to try to create jobs, and that some of that money gets diverted to his political cronies, so that's not even to be credited for where job growth exists. And Jared Bernstein, the former White House economist, has pointed out that much of those jobs are actual government jobs, and there's been a decline of private sector jobs there. Excuse me if I'm butchering his numbers and I'm doing it from memory, but that's my recollection of what Bernstein was saying. So you just have a slew of things being thrown at it, and arguably too many things for it to, you know, jump out and become a media narrative. For the one point, you probably weren't even aware about a lot of these things because it hasn't really been regurgitated in a lot of mainstream press. And I don't know yet if someone's going to latch on to one or two of these things and make that well known, or, as Kevin Drum pointed out, being a buzzkill on the left, I mean, he listed every one of these things in a blog that's been put out there, and then ended up saying, you know, even if all this stuff is true, it's still hard to tear down someone who's had, you know, net job growth, regardless of the quality of jobs, regardless of how they got there. Compare that to someone who's going to be perceived in a bad economy, that's going to seem like a very defensive position to take. And he's going to be able to get away with saying very cleanly and simply, I created jobs, period.
And that strikes me as a pretty savvy political assessment of it. I mean, and surely the other Republican candidates are going to go after this as well. On the right, one of the first bloggers to tackle this and say, you know, do these numbers hold up, was Matthias Shapiro, who's kind of famous in the conservative blog world for he's known as Political Math, at Political Math on Twitter. He's really big into like the visualizations of things, likes finding data rather than, you know, dealing in the rhetoric for people. And he starts off, he has a huge post that was making the rounds this week called Rick Perry and Texas Job Numbers. He says, full disclosure, I don't like Rick Perry for our next president. I have my reasons that aren't worth going into here. However, when I was watching the GOP debate and pro-Perry people started bringing up Rick Perry's job numbers as a cudgel against other candidates, I started looking into the BLS data on Texas jobs. Note, if you're going to comment, I want you to introduce some new objection to Texas job numbers, and you must provide original data. I spent 4 hours digging through raw data to write this post. And then he goes through pretty much each one of the things you just mentioned and looks at the data to assess, you know, true, untrue, how do they all stack up. And so he looks at things, for instance, like, sure, Texas has lots of jobs, but they're mostly low-paying minimum wage jobs. And he says, take a look at the data. Here's the link. The Texas median hourly wage is $15.14, almost exactly in the middle of the pack. Given that they've seen exceptional job growth and other states haven't, it doesn't seem exceptionally low. The implication is that the new jobs in Texas, the jobs that Texas seems to stand alone in creating at a remarkable pace, are the low-paying jobs that don't count. But if this were true, these low-paying jobs would be dragging down wages data. But if we look at the data, it turns out the opposite is true. Since the recession started, hourly wages in Texas have increased at the sixth fastest pace in the nation. And then he looks at other things like, is it all energy-related jobs? And says, you know, the energy sector only makes up for 3% of all employment in Texas. So, you know, it accounts for some of a large portion of the increases, but it's not overwhelming, and it's not enough to say that you know, that's not true. He acknowledges that a lot of the growth comes from these public sector jobs, but says, you know, counting from the beginning of the recession, Texas public sector has grown 3.8%. It's faster than normal employment, but it's not off the charts. And he ends up making the point where he says a lot of the reason why, you know, the big argument that Rick Perry's not so great is the Texas unemployment rate is still at 8.2%, which is better than the national average, but considering all this talk about this huge miracle, you'd almost think it would be lower. And he makes the case that most of the reason why Texas unemployment rate remains so high has to do with population changes and the fact that people are all sort of flooding into Texas. And that's, as the population is going up, it's making it, you know, you've got to catch up even faster with more and more jobs. And so he said if the population of Texas had remained stagnant, and he acknowledges that's not a perfect way of looking at it, but if all of the states had kept their exact same population from the start of the recession till now, Texas comparatively would have the lowest unemployment rate of all of them. So I think
that's a big statistical.
It is a big statistical, and he acknowledges it throughout the post. He says this is not perfect, but what I'm trying to illustrate is 8.2 unemployment's not horrible if you consider that a lot of the reason why it's not significantly lower is because people are just flooding into Texas looking for work, and they have a higher bigger immigrant population, so that state is growing more as well.
I mean, Felix Salmon at Reuters also pointed out that the employment to population ratio in Texas is lower than the national average and has gone down specifically on Perry's watch. And it's hard to separate out, you know, jobs and population. I mean, if you look at Obama's job growth since the recession was officially over, if you take the job numbers from when he entered office, you know, the employment numbers are very bad because he came in at the rock bottom with 800,000 jobs being lost per month, and that didn't, you know, stop on a dime. Part of what the Recovery Act did was to prevent that from getting worse, you know, creating a floor and then allowing recovery to begin. So you could say just net jobs. He's had net job growth, private sector, for several months now, but it's not matching population growth, and that's why it doesn't feel all that great nationwide. So if you're not gonna give Obama credit for the jobs he's created relative to population growth, you can't, you know, give Perry, you know, you can't grade Perry on a curve then.
Yeah, that's one of the big things is you can't say that. There are some folks who are trying to say, well, maybe Perry doesn't necessarily get credit. you either have to blame, you have to give people who are in control credit and blame for the economy, or you have to sort of uniformly not give them credit and blame for the economy. That it's, you know, both Republicans and Democrats may try to play both sides and say, like, well, Obama's going to get credit if there's a recovery, but Rick Perry doesn't get any credit for jobs growth in Texas. Or, on the other hand, Republicans saying, like, Obama is terrible, he's to blame for, you know, a recession, but then I don't support Rick Perry in the primary, so I'm going to diminish his ability to have created jobs in Texas because government doesn't create jobs. So it's an interesting little rhetorical thing that I think both sides, you know, are they going to stay consistent in offering credit and blame to politicians based on the unemployment rates over which they presided? The other big thing that Rick Perry is going to have to deal with is the Bush effect. Is he George W. Bush the sequel? And that's been, like, another big point that's come up since he jumped into the race. He kind of sort of came out the gate immediately with some cowboy rhetoric about the Fed being almost treasonous. He took a lot of flack for that from Bush administration officials over those comments. But I actually wrote a post for the Huffington Post for pollster.com about, you know, is Rick Perry a national or a niche candidate? Is he somebody who has been really successful in Texas, but his vibe is just not going to fly outside of the Lone Star State? And if you look at how he performed with swing groups in Texas, so not looking at how he performed at the base, but looking at how he performed with swing groups, Perry's actually done relatively well. And he's done well, he's ran about equal to where John McCain ran in 2008, and his standing among swing groups like independents, like Latinos in Texas, you know, initially I heard some Republicans saying, oh, well, Rick Perry does really well among Latino voters in Texas, so maybe this will help him branch out. He actually runs about as well with Latino voters as did House Republicans nationwide in 2010. So the major thesis is that...
And that wasn't very good.
Yeah, it was Perry won 38% of Latinos when he ran for re-election for governor in 2010. So my major point was that I don't see him, you know, it's not as though independents hate him and he only wins by just churning out some huge conservative base. On the other hand, running as well as John McCain did is not going to win you the presidency. that's sort of a really low bar to set. So he will have to do better among swing groups if he wants to really be a national candidate that could be contended with were he to win the nomination.
I just want to cite briefly, there was a Nate Silver post at the New York Times 538 blog where he said that Perry ran worse relative to other Texas Republican candidates on the ballot, to suggest that he's had his issues in Texas, and the Democratic Strategist blog picked that up and said maybe if his jobs record was all that good, why would he be doing worse than other Republicans in his state? And that's maybe not quite in sync with what you're saying, but it's sort of in the ballpark.
Well, and he's using, to his credit, I think he's actually using a better comparison there because he's using other Republicans in the same year in the same state. I was trying to look more at presidential data, but again, it's really tough to compare off-year gubernatorial data to presidential level. But mostly I wanted to just see, you know, does he just crater out with independents? Does he get no votes from the Hispanic community? But I also wanted to temper a little bit of the excitement that I was hearing from some conservative bloggers who were saying, like, oh, he can assemble a coalition as if he were, you know, magic. And so... You know, I think if he wants to be a serious candidate, he is going to have to pivot out of running the way he runs in Texas. And there's a post by Eric Erickson at Red State, who, no fan of Mitt Romney's, says this is still Mitt Romney's race to lose. That, like, conservative bloggers are very excited about Rick Perry, but that, you know, no Huntsman, no Paul, you know, Michelle Bachmann, these other people are not going to actually pose a threat. Rick Perry could, but... Romney doesn't need excitement and energy. Like, Romney can kind of screw up a little because he's already got enough dings on his record, and he still keeps chugging. Whereas Rick Perry is vulnerable to flame out, or if he underperforms in an early primary state or two, he could go Howard Dean and just, you know, evaporate. Whereas Romney's got the endurance machine built. So I think that's, you know, we'll see. Can Rick Perry build a nationwide endurance machine, or is he best left running for governor of Texas?
Well, how are conservative bloggers reacting to the past week? Rick Perry came in with a big splash, quickly you know, rattled off several provocative comments or gaffes, depending on your perspective. And, you know, I've always sensed with conservative voters to date, as much as they love Sarah Palin or Michelle Bachmann or Herman Cain or Newt Gingrich, there is a strain there that seems to be saying, I really want to win, and I don't want to sacrifice my ideology too much to do that, but if I see someone getting completely hammered in the traditional media and they're not being taken seriously, I'm not going to take a chance on that.
Mm-hmm.
And the hope was that Rick Perry, seasoned campaigner, longest-serving governor in the country, jobs record you could sell, he wouldn't suffer the kind of dings that Michelle Bachmann had been getting upon her rise to first-tier status. Is there any conservative bloggers saying, oh, crap, he's getting the same treatment as Michelle Bachmann's getting? Or are they saying, this is the Rick Perry I was looking for. He's leaning forward. He's being aggressive. He's gonna take it to Obama. He's not going to get turned around and not the way Mitt Romney is. Which way is it falling?
Well, I think it's generally, you know, Tim Pawlenty was kind of meek, attempting to be not meek, and it didn't seem authentic, and he quickly faded, whereas Rick Perry's sort of the opposite of that. He's forceful, and he's going to have to try to tone it back down a little bit, and he's been getting a good reception. The two issues on which I've seen conservative bloggers, you know, make some comments to the effect that there are concerns about him, one has to do with his mandate that girls in the state of Texas get vaccinated against HPV.
Michelle Malkin has made that practically a crusade to get that story out, it seems.
Yeah, and because, I mean, if you think about it, one of the biggest knocks against Mitt Romney is going to be this individual mandate. Well, here, this wasn't just a mandate to have health care. This was a mandate to give people shots about, I mean, and not necessarily...
It's the nanny state run amok.
And you know, there was an analysis done, I think, by Politico of all the documents around it, and it showed that Rick Perry actually wasn't really involved in the decision, but if you're the governor of the state, it's still your decision. The other big thing that Philip Klein brought up over at the Washington Examiner's Beltway Confidential blog is about Texas' high uninsured rate, and it said it has a lot to do with the fact that insurance is really expensive in Texas. Texas is a state where insurance is required to cover an awful lot. He says another factor is that despite being a low-regulation state in many ways, Texas actually ranks fourth when it comes to mandating insurers offer certain benefits in all of their policies. Texas has 60 such mandates that drive up the cost of insurance. And he points out that because Texas has a younger population and no mandate, a lot of young people just choose not to buy insurance because it's more expensive there. They're young, they're invincible, they don't think they need it. And that's why you have this higher uninsured rate. But he says this could, if we're going back to the electability conversation, be a big problem because it presents almost, in many ways, a perfect contrast. You know, Obama can say, I'm working to bring down the level of uninsured people and I'm trying to prevent this high level of uninsured. I am trying to prevent high levels of those without having I can't even talk today. You know what I'm trying to say. I am bringing down the number of uninsured in America. Yes, I can speak English again. And this presents, you know, a possibly really problematic contrast if he were to become the Republican nominee. Because while on the other hand, Mitt Romney, you know, you can say, oh, well, his healthcare plan has many similarities with Obama. I mean, it's sort of like Perry's the opposite side of that coin.
So, you know, we haven't seen Michelle Bachmann yet carry this charge that Rick Perry is not conservative enough.
No, we haven't seen it yet.
Yet, right.
Give it time.
Maybe she will. But I mean, I think Ron Paul has been trying to push that button, and you're seeing some conservative bloggers do it. Although I wouldn't think it was the majority of conservative bloggers. For talking to Matt last week, he said conservative bloggers were generally on the Perry bandwagon.
Yeah, here's sort of a thing, and Matt will probably be better to speak about this because I think he was there. But Rick Perry's been, I think, eyeing the presidency for a little while and had like a blogger summit.
We talked about that
last
week.
Yeah, I figured you guys had.
And Perry essentially has been very, sort of unique in Matt's reporting of very aggressive blogger outreach for a long time. And in fact made his presidential announcement at a blogger gathering.
Yeah, and so, and I think that's part of why, I mean, I almost can't believe I'm going to say this, I feel bad for Michelle Bachmann. I mean, she poured so much effort into winning the Ames straw poll, performed, you know, I guess reasonably well in the Fox News debate, and nobody cares. I don't know how it's possible for someone to win the Ames straw poll and come away as, like, a weaker candidate that nobody's talking about.
Well,
I'm not that nobody's talking about, but...
Yeah, I mean,
normally
I would,
one would
I
get a boost out of that, and Perry just squashed it.
I mean, Perry did take the oxygen out of what momentum one would normally get from an event like that.
Yeah.
But that's because, I mean, it's not like if, you know, if John Huntsman did that, announced on the Saturday, it wouldn't have had that effect. It's because as soon as Perry got in, polls showed him performing in the top tier automatically. So there was some sense that this was a guy that you did have to take seriously, regardless of what, you know, one straw poll on a straw poll is not an accurate reflection of what's going to happen on election day. So I don't think it was, you know, wrong of the media to give Perry attention, although I would say I think the media's criteria on who they give attention to at a given moment is completely arbitrary and often irrational.
Yes. It's whatever the latest shiny thing is. Rick Perry's shiny right now.
Absolutely, and Bachman's not as shiny. But if I think Bachman gets more attention having won than, say, Ron Paul, if he won, Ron Paul came in close, And the Paulites are moaning that, you know, why isn't either he's only a few hundred votes away, why doesn't he get you know, similar attention? 'Cause, I mean, reporters do know that in one respect the straw poll is a somewhat worthless exercise that is not about your actual breadth of support in the state of Iowa. It's about how many people can you bus in.
Right.
And we all know that Paulites can bust people in. Paulites can do money bombs. They can win straw polls. They've won straw polls before, but time and time again, those straw polls do not result in any discernible votes at the polls on election day because he has a very narrow slice of support that happens to be very intense, which is good for straw polls and bad for election days. So until Paul can prove any evidence that he's growing beyond that, he's not going to get media attention. Now, Bachman, I think, gets more attention because she showed she did have some organization in Iowa. She's not just, you know, a TV candidate. She, you know, you can mock her and say, well, she bought 6,000 tickets and 4,500 people voted for her. Well, she got 500 people to show up on her behalf, which Tim Pawlenty could not do, despite having invested tons of resources in Iowa organizations. So some people might say it's ridiculous that Pawlenty flinches at this one big loss, but if you can't bus in 4,000 people, you can't meet that low bar.
Especially if you bet your whole campaign on it.
Yeah.
And this wasn't just some media narrative that got cooked up that the campaign didn't feed. I mean, they themselves, I think, could really kind of, they're doubling down on Iowa. Let's do it. So,
I mean, this was a test of how good the organization is. You've hired the right people. You know, I'm sure they weren't incompetent. I'm sure you have very talented people and a very tightly run operation. Just there aren't actual bodies of people that want to vote for Tim Pawlenty.
Well, and I think
you hit that wall, you have a problem.
Well, it's because you have really big, you run into a lot of trouble when you are trying to convince voters to get on a bus and vote for you on the grounds that you have a really great organization. And the problem with the Pawlenty campaign, I think, from day one, and I know you wrote a post about this, so I'm interested to hear your take, too, is that, I mean, I would say half the press releases that, popped up to me from the Pawlenty campaign were, he makes hire so-and-so, he gets endorsement so-and-so, this is how he fundraised last quarter, and it was all very process-oriented. And in many ways, that's exactly the campaign that Mitt Romney ran in 2008. It was the, okay, you guys don't know me yet, but look, I'm going to build this huge tank, and we are going to roll it into Iowa, and I'm going to win. And it didn't work for Mitt Romney, because he, you know, and he couldn't pull it off, and he bet everything. No,
he could win straw polls. He could at least win straw polls.
Correct. He could win straw polls.
He successfully bust people in.
You know, and he didn't have a Michelle Bachman, and at that point, Huckabee hadn't really, you know, pulled a Michelle Bachman and, like, caught on. But, I mean, Pawlenty's campaign wasn't about ideas. At one point, he said, I want 5% economic growth. And then there was some, but if you asked me, what does Tim Pawlenty want to do? Be president. But I, as somebody who's a reasonably informed Republican primary voter, I couldn't tell you what Tim Pawlenty was really going for. And I think it's tough to get people on buses when you lack that.
Well, that speaks to what my own blog post was, which is I happened to be at CPAC, my one CPAC adventure in 2007, and I saw Tim Pawlenty speak, and he was the only speaker I saw that tried to challenge conservative orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. And he had this big speech about how let's not be country club Republicans, let's be Sam's Club Republicans, and that means we have to take middle class problems seriously, and they having problems with, you know, affordable energy and health care. We have to support importing prescription drugs from Canada so they can be cheaper. We need to invest in renewable energy that people can afford. We need to take seriously the issue of the uninsured population. And the crowd that I saw was like, who the hell is – am I at CPAC? What's going on here? Who's this guy? And the only guy that seemed to catch on what he was doing was Matthew Continetti at Weekly Standard, who wrote a fairly glowing piece for Pawlenty after that speech. And he suggested that Pawlenty successfully turned people around and got them thinking at CPAC. But as I suggested in my post, like the past 4 years suggest otherwise, that no one – had any idea what or any interest in following what Pawlenty was selling. And Pawlenty himself clearly didn't buy that people had been intrigued by his Sam's Club frame, because he never talked about it mm-hmm. in the primary. So he had showed no interest in carving out his own distinct issues platform and challenging any faction of the Republican Party to be better positioned for the general election. You could say, well, that would be crazy because you can't run against your base in a Republican primary. And, you know, maybe so. Maybe there's just no way for Pawlenty to win this thing. But certainly being a milquetoast version of the Tea Party Republican that every other candidate in the race is trying to be got you 1% of the vote and an early exit. So it would seem, and I think this is a warning shot to Huntsman, if you're going to try to get any discernible support at all, you got to plant your flag somewhere.
Yeah.
You got to take on some aspect of the party that you think is dragging down the party's chances in November, and you might still lose, but you at least might make an impact and stand for something and maybe, you know, lose the battle and win the war later. Otherwise, you're just going to be sticking around at 1% for the entire time. What's the point in that?
Yeah, I think everybody he was kind of underwhelming in the last debate, although kudos to him for sticking with some of his more controversial policy positions on a Fox News Republican stage. I mean, he didn't back down from civil unions. So, I think you may kind of get your wish to see if there's a candidate who can run. I don't want to say against the base, because he does, you know, talk about himself as a conservative, but somebody with a lot of positions that are not necessarily the orthodox Republican way of viewing something, can he pull it off?
Well, I'm particularly curious. I mean, everyone on the Republican stage has flinched at cap and trade, even though it was originally a Republican idea, and Romney had been for it at one time, and Gingrich had been for it at one time, and Pawlenty had been for it at one time, and Huntsman had been for it at one time. And Pawlenty flat out said, you know, that was a clunker. That was a mistake. I'm just going to, you know, expunge that from my record. And Huntsman hasn't done, you know, maybe not 180, but a 160 on it, and saying, well, it's not working. It's not the right time now. And so in the Fox News debate, yes, he did stick to his guns on civil unions, but he went off in this whole, you know, the EPA is committing a reign of terror, which I just find, I don't believe for 1 second Huntsman actually believes that. When I saw that, I said to myself, well, he's going to fall into the same Pawlenty trap. But now, as of this week, Rick Perry went straight up climate science denial, which, you know, no Republican presidential candidate has done for a long time. Bush was officially not a denier. He said it was actually happening, so he was going to do something about it. It didn't, but he said he would. McCain said he was going to do something about it, said it was really happening. So Huntsman's spokesperson, John Weaver, said on the record that, you know, we're not going to be a national party if we deny science.
There was a tweet today. I just pulled this up from Huntsman. It was and he says, to be clear, I believe in evolution and trust scientists on global warming. Call me crazy.
The Huntsman said that?
Yeah, it's a Huntsman tweet from this afternoon.
Now, do you know what that's in reference to?
Yeah, it's in reference to Rick Perry saying he, you know, I believe it was that he considers evolution to be a theory.
Has gaps in the theory. And this was actually...
Are you looking for the missing link? Sorry,
right.
I don't...
And this was something that... A semi-staged confrontation, a mother was clearly, you know, prodding her son to ask him these pointed questions about evolution and science. But nevertheless, regardless of how it came about, that's how he answered the question. He didn't have to answer the question that way. And you are seeing more more liberals go to these conservative events, whether it's congressional town halls or presidential events, and prod the candidates and try to goad them. When Romney said corporations are people, it's because there were liberals there heckling him about raising taxes. Mm-hmm. So I don't know who is organizing it. I see Think Progress covers them a lot. I know they do send people to track at times, but I don't know if these are Think Progress people per se, but it's possible.
Vast left-wing conspiracy, obviously.
I mean, I don't think it's that big of a conspiracy. You're allowed to send people to events and have them say things.
I know.
but so that could be what's going on there. And so for Huntsman to sort of take that on, I mean, if Huntsman does say, I'm going to be the pro-science candidate, and you know, we can debate how we get there and how much government should be involved and have market-based solutions for things, but we're going to be a fact-based party, a science-based party, if I have anything to say about it. If he took that fight on, I think he would – I'm not saying he'd win, but he would get more than 1%. I'm sure there's a constituency of Republicans who is actually pro-science that Huntsman could appeal to if he had the guts to take that fight on.
And I think that Mitt Romney is the person who would be the most nervous about that, because Romney's also come out and said, I believe climate change is happening. I believe that mankind is playing a role in it. I don't know how big that role is, but I believe it is. And so that's that. I mean, that's out there. Mitt Romney has said that. So he's, you know, there is another mainstream Republican candidate whose take is not a climate science. You know, he believes that climate change is happening. He believes mankind has a role in it. So Huntsman's not the only one, although I can guarantee you will not see Mitt Romney make this a centerpiece of his campaign.
Right.
Maybe he could.
Right. I agree with that completely. We have only a little bit of time left. I know we both have to run. Let's talk about Obama's jobs tour.
Yes.
And its relation to deficit reduction, the super committee, quickly. Certainly, the news of the past couple of days has been that he is about to announce a bigger jobs package than he has previously put on the table as of this year, but tie it to even bigger cuts in the deficit, bigger than what the super committee is legally tasked to accomplish, to pay for whatever jobs proposal he's going to produce. And since put an extra level of grandness on whatever a grand bargain might look like. And you're seeing on the left, a fair amount of left, I'd say, inherent skepticism about the strategy. I mean, most prominent liberal bloggers are disinterested in any kind of grand bargain. And, you know, Digby in particular was incredulous. Jed Lewison at Daily Kos, who often is a more sympathetic choice to Obama, just that I still think this is going to work. If you put that compromise on the table, it's just going to, you know, all the job stuff's going to fall by the wayside, and you're left with the bigger cuts that you don't want as a standalone. But Jonathan Cohen of the New Republic was saying more hopeful that perhaps this might even have a shot dislodging some of the Republican recalcitrants. If you can get the debate to be about jobs and to have opposition to your package be the anti-jobs position, when there is such fervor in the country about the job situation, that might actually box Republicans in, force them to say, how can you walk away from a package that is going to be, you know, significant net deficit reduction and be sold as creating jobs at the same time? That's the hopeful take on it, but that's, I'd say, a minority take in the liberal blogosphere, not the majority take.
I would say that on the conservative side, well, first of all, the Washington Post headline on Thursday morning was, like, Obama plans to unveil new stimulus or something like that, which I can imagine people's heads just exploding inside the White House, like, no, don't call it stimulus. Because that seems to be, that's the big point that you're hearing from conservative bloggers. Oh, this is just more stimulus. How can he possibly think that more stimulus is what we need? There's a really good, I thought, kind of nuanced, bright take on this by Raihan Salam at NRO, who's referencing a Jackie Collins New York Times piece where she is kind of making the case for a new round of fiscal stimulus. And, you know, references Martin Feldstein, who was one of President Reagan's Council of Economic Advisors, because he is advocating raising revenue and would do so by limiting tax expenditures, the costly tax breaks for corporations and individuals that include the mortgage interest deduction. And on the other hand, he supports he advocated for stimulus initially, but not the sort of stimulus that it wound up being. So the stimulus wound up being a lot of, like, plugging big gaps in state budgets rather than and trying and sort of masking over the insolvency of a lot of states, rather than investing in infrastructure and doing the sorts of things that presumably an infrastructure bank or a next round of stimulus would be. But I think it was Peter Suderman at Hit and Run. He had a post just focusing on sort of the failures when it came to creating green jobs. He said, here are some lowlights. Last week, Obama toured to much fanfare a Johnson Controls plant in Michigan, where $300 million in conservation grants produced 150 jobs at a cost of $2 million per position. In Seattle, a $20 million federal grant for home weatherization has retrofitted only 3 houses and created 14 jobs. And he says, as the job creation rhetorical wars reach threat level 5 in Washington, it's worth remembering that as the problem with jobs, that the problem with jobs initiatives, green and otherwise, is that creating sustainable, productive jobs, the kind of employment that lasts and adds to the nation's productivity, is a hard thing to do. And there's no reason to think that government bureaucrats, torn by a mob of competing political interests, are somehow better than private sector operators. On the other hand, I've heard from folks like Raihan the belief that, look, if we're going to spend money on infrastructure at some point in the next 10 years, you know, we've got all these roads that are in disrepair, we've got all of these things that need to be done, you may as well do it now when you can borrow at really low interest rates. But if it's going to be this second stimulus, it really needs to be the shovel-ready stuff that we were promised the first time around, but that, you know, things didn't turn out to be as shovel-ready as they had thought. Now, I don't think that idea is the mainstream in the conservative blogosphere. I think the mainstream in the conservative blogosphere is, hell no, we're not doing another stimulus. But there are some bloggers of the more policy wonk variety who are open to the idea of doing something if it is legitimately making an investment in infrastructure, and not like high-speed rail, shiny trains, but like making our roads actually better. Because it's better to have, you know, we have all this labor out there. It's better to have folks working than not working, and to have something tangible at the end to pay off for it, instead of we just plugged a hole on a state budget, and then a year later the state's insolvent again.
Well, I'm happy to hear that there's some conservatives out there interested in investing in infrastructure, because that kind of bipartisan support is necessary if they're ever going to get an infrastructure bank passed. But I just to be honest about what that kind of thing would do. I mean, the Recovery Act had a mixture of things. I mean, it had infrastructure, it had the state budget gap plugging, it had tax cuts. You know, it was really, in that sense, sort of every possible ideological thing you would try to do was in there, and you could argue maybe it would spread too thin.
So loaded toward the tax cuts, the payroll. You know, it was loaded toward sort of either transfer payments or keeping states. I mean, I think it wound up being only like 3% of the stimulus went to the sorts of infrastructure spending, which in the discussion of it, it didn't sound like, you know, bridges and roads would be shovel ready with 3%.
The difficult thing is, and you know, and FDR had the same issue, big infrastructure stuff is never shovel ready. Those are long-term projects. It's good investments. And so, therefore, when you do these sort of, you know, dollars divided into number of jobs, it's sort of a misnomer, because it's not just about the job, it's about the infrastructure left behind that you get. Mm-hmm. That's also what you're paying for. But those sort of big infrastructure projects are not quick things. Those don't solve your immediate crisis. They help to some degree, and they have long-term payoffs. You know, FDR had a point in the middle of its first term where the initial stimulus stuff started to stall out, and he had to shift away from the big ticket infrastructure stuff, which he was already trying to do, into more of the, you know, the ticky tacky make work stuff, which sort of got mocked as being boondoggles. But that stuff was stuff that created the quick jobs, because they you just do them right away. Infrastructure bank, I think, is absolutely essential. I think there's $2 trillion worth of infrastructure repairs that needs to be done, and it's a way to do it that doesn't cost the federal government, the taxpayers, a lot of money. But that's not going to create insto shovel-ready jobs. That's just not what it's designed to do.
Well, but if, I mean, and the argument then being, hey, we gave you a shot, $800 billion worth of a shot last time, had we started this back then, maybe those shovel-ready jobs would be happening now. And instead, we got, I mean, I think it was Mary Catherine Hamm at the Daily Caller. She did a video about, and it was kind of a satirical video, about the stimulus project that is physically closest to the White House. And it is a dog park in a wealthy neighborhood of Washington, D.C. That is like a ticky-tacky make-work project. I mean, that's it's not necessary to our nation's infrastructure, period. Whereas I think... I just think that if the stimulus had, that a lot of the reason why the stimulus gets such a bad rap is A, because it was a lot of money and people are going, okay, I saw a road with a stimulus sign on it and I saw like two guys working on it, but usually it's just a traffic backup and there aren't people there. I mean, that's anecdotal, but I think I at least am, you know, I would like to see not necessarily some big new stimulus, but I'm comfortable with the idea that, you know, if we're going to fix our infrastructure, let's fix it now. I'm just worried that, like, I don't necessarily trust that the money, not that I distrust the administration on it, but that I distrust the government function of distributing the money and picking the projects to work, because I don't necessarily like how it worked the last time.
Well, two things I'd say. One, I mean, there wasn't just make-work stuff. Far from it, just make-work stuff in the Recovery Act. I mean, there's high-speed rail money, there's smart grid money, advanced battery manufacturing. These are all things that are tended to be long-range. I mean, there's actually much more geared to long-range stuff. In fact, Biden's job in administration was to go to all the mayors saying, you are not doing swimming pools, you are not doing skate parks, you are not doing those sorts of things. You're only going to do the big
ticket
stuff.
Well, he missed the one right in D.C. Joe, get with the program.
But if Republicans were really concerned that there wasn't enough meaty infrastructure in the bill, and there should have been this infrastructure bank, which is essentially an attempt to have a public-private partnership and use a small amount of federal money to leverage private sector investment. If they really wanted that, and they went to Obama in January 2009, we would love to vote for this package. Would you just have the infrastructure bank? They would have gotten that deal. I do not think they were actually asking for that at the time.
I agree. I think they were looking at the price tag and going, this is crazy. But I think... if you're going to spend the money, it's better to spend it the right way. And so I think if Obama is packaging this infrastructure bank with a promise to cut even more in spending somewhere else, I think you'll hear a lot of the Boehner-type folks perking up because they want to be able to be a part of creating jobs as well. And, you know, what faster way can the government create jobs if the government is the one that's going to be creating the jobs than by directly spending it to hire contractors to do things. So,
why don't we leave it on that note?
Okay.
Always great to talk to
great
you.
Great talking to you too.
And
next time we talk, Matt may get this topic, but I learned a new term today while talking to Bill before the show. The term firebagger.
Yeah, I'm sure we're gonna get to that today.
Yeah, can't get to that today, but we'll get to that soon.
Okay. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week on the Week in Blog. Take care.